This is Mae Warren.
Today is November 1st, 1996. I'm in Davidson, North Carolina with Gil Holland. And
1830 Davis Road. Well, we were talking about the good old things about W&L and why I went there. My the headmaster at Episcopal High School in Alexandria was a Yale man and wanted me to go up there, but no contest. My father and uncle, and also his brother, Uncle Charles, had been to W&L, driven all the way up the unpaved dirt road in the middle of Florida, averaging, they said, a flat tire about every 50 miles. They had moved to Miami. So I'm going to say a little bit about my father.
Correct.
He had moved as a boy with his brother and parents from Chicago to Miami when there were 50,000 inhabitants in Miami and not a structure on Miami Beach. And it must have been a great time for Florida. And my grandfather thought big. Our son thinks he didn't go to chapel. He didn't go to W&L, but he thinks big. So this vision came from somewhere, I guess. When Uncle Charles and Daddy were teenagers, they went with their parents on a cruise through the Panama Canal up the Pacific coast and over on the Canadian Pacific to Lake Louise. Stayed at the big hotel.
Chateau Lake Louise.
And have you been there?
I was there this summer.
Were you really? And my family and I went camping one of the four summers we spent in California, up in Alberta, and actually walked through that old hotel. It was quite exciting. So I think I went to the right school because I'm close to the family. And then prophetically, our daughter, Siri Lisa, went from Salem Academy in Winston-Salem to join the second group of women to hit the beach. And she loved it. S-I-R-I, second word, L-I-S-E. Okay. And my wife's from Norway, and that's a Norwegian name. So that's the reason I guess I went. And what did I like about it? My goodness. We can start with the faculty. I guess I was pre-med first off, and then with my father was a doctor, and our dream was to practice together. That wasn't to be since he died in 58. But when I decided I didn't want to devote my life to medicine, and I like to read books too much, and switch to English, he was supportive. And so good science teachers, and I had good humanities teachers. Gil Reith, I can remember a number of Y's in chemistry. I liked the chemistry lab in particular. And lots of camaraderie in chemistry lab. Where you get to blow up things and burn holes in your clothes together. And that was great fun. Making good friends in chemistry lab. Then when I switched to English, I had already taken courses from Professor Fitzgerald Flournoy, and I took as many from him as I possibly could. He, as you probably know, had been a Rhodes Scholar and come back to Washington and Lee. And one of his teachers from Oxford came through and gave a lecture once, and I had the privilege of driving him and his wife to Charlottesville the next day. And I remember he wanted to know why Dr. Flournoy had never written anything. And there was some question as to whether he had, whether returning to his alma mater had been the best thing for him. But he certainly inspired lots of students. He had great presence, and when he read Shakespeare aloud, I had the English romantics and Chaucer from him too, but when he read Shakespeare He had every boy's heart in the class. Apparently, there were lots of stories about him. One of which was that he prepared in the summertime when he prepared his lectures. He usually was standing up in the stream, up to his waist in the stream, and writing out these marvelous lectures. I think he did that for a Shelley lecture once. And
did you ever see him doing that?
No, I didn't ever. Yes.
That's what you all who just go to school then miss. You missed the summer in Hartford.
Yes.
We all do everything up to our waist or up to our necks in the water.
That's right.
Cool.
That's right. But I remember down at the central lunch called the Liquid Lunch, Dr. Fernoy had liked to go down there and have a beer and talk to the locals. And the students, when we would wander in there, I think he was much more interested in talking to the local people than he was talking to any of his students.
Like what local? What kind of
people? Local, you know, the local types. You live there. Unspoiled by higher education.
But did you know any of those people?
Oh, sure. We talked. No, I can't think of any. We just talked to lots of the local people, but I don't remember any names. We got to know the black people and who worked in the fraternity. Napoleon, you might know Napoleon. Do you know him?
Napoleon Borges.
He still waits. He's a bartender. When I go back, it's always fun to see him.
He
was a fellow with great style, and his mother also worked at our fraternity. A lovely person, and very tolerant of. The fraternity house, in those days, I tell this when I go back, and when I went back to see our daughter and meet her friends, these fraternity houses these days look like barns, and I tell them that in those days, we had white tablecloths, and for banquets, we wore black tie tux. It was very, very classy. I thought Mrs. Wagner was our house mother. Do they have house mothers again? Have they reintroduced those? She was quite a civilizing influence on us. She was a genteel lady from Lynchburg, Virginia, who could recite entire Shakespearean plays. And she, in her own way, just her presence, kept us civilized. She had a room on the first floor, I remember, and in those days, the school rule was no dates above the first floor during the school year. In the finals, which took place after the final exam, dates were all over on the roof and every place. But that rule was not violated, and I think in part because of respect. Oh, here's one story. I don't know whether you want to use it or not, but I was upstairs in a room above her room, and some of my friends were swearing in rather unusual ways. Then all of a sudden, Mrs. Wagner appeared at the door. That was unheard of, that she would go up the steps, and she said, "I don't mind a good lusty goddamn now and then, but this is too much." So here's a salute to Mrs. Wagner, I think. I'm just kind of rambling. I know you asked me about local people, but yeah, that's what you want me to do. I hadn't thought of Mrs. Wagner in a long time. But the other professors, well, there was Dr. Shillington, and I mentioned Dr. Wise, and
no, you didn't mention Dr. Wise. Who's Dr. Wise?
In chemistry, he was a chemist. He's still there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the math professor who would serve, what was his name? He served tomato juice on the Monday after big party weekends. I had him for an 8:30 class in calculus. He was wonderful. What's his name? I can't quite remember.
He served tomato
in class, that's right. The name will come to me eventually. But I remember Dr. Nelson in English. Dr. Laban, of course, inspired lots of people. I had sociology and also classics from him. And one story I can remember, I remember seeing his handwriting, very precise, his italic script in the margins on papers, which he got back quite promptly. In the classics course every year in studying Thucydides, there was a point at which he would read from Thucydides in Greek, and when the Greeks saw the sea, they shouted, I can't remember the Greek word, the sea, and his eyes would fill with tears, apparently, annually. Quite genuinely and annually. he gave a concert once. He sang and played Gilbert and Sullivan. He was a one-man show. It was a real, he got a big kick out of that. I remember Marshall Fishwick in freshman history gave lots of little tests. He was a very entertaining teacher, but I remember he didn't care for the fact that I crammed and closed my book only when the test went up. I remember he walked back. What did he do? Did he grab that book once or slam that book? I liked Dr. Fishwick. I have one of his books that I've wanted to have him sign but never have. A couple of things I don't want to forget to tell you. One's a short piece on Arnold Toynbee's visit, and then a longer piece on Faulkner's visit. I remember Arnold Toynbee came, and all I remember was that perhaps Dr. Jenks moderated. In any case, we were in Lee Chapel, and there was a panel. And Toynbee, what impressed me about Toynbee was he was such a good listener. And every 2 minutes, he would be looking very intently at whoever was speaking on the panel. And every 2 minutes, he would say, yes, yes, so unconsciously, yes. But the story I do want you to have is the side of William Faulkner that came out when he spoke in Lee Chapel. I guess he was living in Charlottesville when his daughter was there, and he came over. I was sitting on the second row, I think, with John Hollister in Atlanta. Did you talk to John? Well, and John later went on and had a Fulbright. He was one of Dr. Jenks's students, had a Fulbright to Vienna. In any case, Faulkner was introduced, and he was to read for 30 minutes and then answer questions. So he stood up. He was a very dapper dresser, the real picture of the dandiacal, and he stood up and he mumbled. He read and he mumbled. It was so embarrassing for that 30 minutes or so. He was reading from his work, and we fidgeted around. We were on the second row. Couldn't make out anything. Couldn't make out anything. And then he just stopped, and he just looked at us. And it must have been a good 2 minutes he just looked at us. It was dead. So finally, someone remembered, he's waiting for questions. And so he stood up. Someone stood up and asked him a question, and Faulkner approached the microphone and in full control, full voice, boomed out these answers. He'd been playing with us the whole time. He did that, if you know the way up at the military at West Point was a famous interview, I think in Life magazine, in which if you read that, you'll see that he played with that interviewer the whole time. Just made him look, and the fellow didn't even realize it. But this is sort of the spirit. A man from, I believe, Hollins, a teacher, stood up and said, Mr. Faulkner, how do you create character? Very earnest, serious question. And Faulkner paused and said, well, I start the characters out walking down the road, and then I'll run along behind them writing down what they do. This fellow got red and sat down. So they were two rather memorable visits, in particular the Faulkner visit. You can check with John Hollister on that. I hope to see him next weekend. He and I were co-captains of the, we were on the wrestling team for a number of years. He was one of the West Virginia boys that furnished the team with some mighty good wrestlers.
Well, I want to get to wrestling, but Toynbee was there for a long time.
I think he was there for half a year or something, a semester perhaps.
So was...
Well, Dr. Jinks, I remember, invited us over, a number of people over to his house for dinner, and I remember shaking his hand there.
So was he a presence on campus, or you?
Well, I was not a history major, and so I think he probably was for the history. And so you'll have to check. You could ask. You could call John Hollister and ask him about that.
Okay.
And then let's see what other speakers I. I can't offhand think of any.
Were you there when Catherine Ann Porter was there?
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
No. That was a little later, I believe.
Okay, yeah, I have to get the years on that, or get the week. She was there
right.
For a week, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what other English teachers were impressive? Because from what I understand, you're a pretty impressive English professor yourself.
No, if I could be half the teacher that Flournoy was, I'd be lucky. I just missed Sid Cowling. He came while I was there, but it was at the very end, and I was missed out on having a class with him. But I liked Professor Nelson and Professor Foster in particular. See, I got into English as a major late, so I didn't have as many courses probably as some of the others. It was sort of I was an English major by default when I got out of pre-med. So I don't. That's about what I've told you about Flournoy is about all I'm going to tell you about him, I think. There are some other stories, but I don't think they bear repeating.
Do you think you modeled yourself as a teacher after the style of teaching at Washington?
No, I don't. I gave up lecturing very shortly after I began. I think I do a much better job leading discussions. And now, in the last few years, every class we sit in a circle, so I only lecture. Everybody in the department lectures to the seniors once a year, and that's my only lecture. So primarily, except for Dr. Borden, Ross Borden, I remember seminars with him, we sat and talked. He had a seminar in contemporary literature. I remember we read Kafka and things like that. And so he was also quite an interesting. Do you know if he's still alive?
I don't know.
Down in Florida, someone said he.
I don't know.
He was a romantic sort of figure, because he was said to have parachuted in behind enemy lines in World War II. So that was quite glamorous. And Dr. Foster's stint in Hollywood, I guess you've talked to Tom Wolfe about that. I guess you will, probably.
Yeah, I've talked to him.
He graduated in 1954, and so I came that fall.
But no crossover.
No, but he had two. I had a niece and a nephew who graduated from Davidson, so I had the honor of introducing him at an assembly down here, and he gave the keynote address. So, here's a story on him. He after the address, of course, he was dressed in white. But he had, maybe it was blue silk socks. But anyway, his mother was there. She came over from Laurinburg, and she said, "Tom, do you have those socks on?" And he pulled up his trouser leg, and sure enough. But he was a very witty. I used one of his books in Victorian literature, and I wrote, and I have the letter I'd written him and asked him what he thought about my smuggling one of his books into Victorian literature, and I have this very nice letter on the wall in my office with his calligraphic hand saying he thought that would be a very nice idea. Good idea to do that. Now let's see, some of the more interesting people in town, now you ask about local people, the landladies and landlords of, you know, in those days it was only a freshman dorm. And so everyone lived out in town. My father said under no circumstances was I allowed to live in the fraternity house. And so he was my wise parent. So I lived with my junior year, Harry Heinisch and I. Harry was a transfer from Davidson. Harry was a great athlete. He could run up House Mountain nonstop. But we lived with some others in Beulah Hutton's house. Beulah was a blind lady in her 70s, and she had owned a department store downtown.
Adair Hutton.
And she claimed that she'd been swindled out of the ownership of that. I don't think you want to use that. There might be somebody alive that would resent that. But she was a gracious, lovely person. And she liked attention, as who doesn't? And so we we go in and tiptoe in and say, "Beulah, this is Vic." Her favorite student of all times was Vic Milner from Danville. She would have loved to have had a visit from Vic, and she'd say, "No, you're not Vic." But I don't know whether you want to use this story or not either. But we would use her kitchen, and you know, for snacks late at night, and make peanut butter sandwiches and everything. And she had a severe water bug problem, and of course, when we went in to make peanut butter sandwiches, we'd turn on the light and the water bugs would disappear. But when she went in to make peanut butter sandwiches, needless to say, she didn't turn the light on. And so sometimes her peanut butter sandwiches were on the crunchy, on the crunchy side.
Oh,
then there were the Ma and is it Pa Gehring? They were down two. These were on the other side of the street from the fraternity house. Ma Gehring, a couple of my friends roomed, and she also kept dates. And when the girls would come down, they had a curfew, and then they would stay either 11 or 12. They would have to be in these different houses. And Pa Gehring, he was a one-legged man, and he always sat in bed. He wouldn't sit in a wheelchair, and smoked these long cigars. They were great company. When Ken Sadler had graduated and he left his dog Sam, they adopted Sam, this boxer. Are you going to talk to Ken Sadler?
I don't know Ken Sadler.
Wow. Anyway, the first thing they did was have a portrait painted of Sam, which hung in the entranceway. Pa Gehring would occasionally say, "Forgive me," he'd say, "Shit." And Ma would say, "You're gonna have to forgive him," but that's his favorite word. You probably don't want to put that in. Better not put that in. But in any case, it was fun knowing some of those local people like that.
How far afield did you go? Where were these houses?
Way across the street from on Washington Street.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So what?
Now we lived my sophomore year. I lived with Ken Sadler and John Tucker. Don't know whether you get in touch with John, who has retired in Savannah. Mm-hmm. Do you know John Tucker?
No.
We lived at Call Alto.
You did?
In the servants' quarters.
Oh.
And that was wonderful. The lady that lived there was way up in years, but we would go in, and she was a wonderful lady, and we would talk about the old times. She had a picture. She'd been a very beautiful young woman. I can't quite remember her name now. But I noticed they were working on it. They were doing something to it. The last time I was up there, they're changing the road or something. But we would slip in the, we would park in the back where, I guess, Mr. Junkin had lived with his studio back there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was about to say,
he had retired, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't take any art, unfortunately, I didn't take any art courses, although I did sit in on, I think Fishwick had an art course that I sat in on. But, all right, let's see now. The fancy dress, the most memorable fancy dress, was when Louis Armstrong was there.
You were there that year?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, tell me about that.
Well, it was just great music, and I remember him blowing his horn in Doremus Gymnasium, and that throat would swell out like that. What a sound. It was another world.
Could you dance to Louis Armstrong?
Sure, we danced. Yeah, we danced. And also, right in Doremus Gymnasium, that must have been where he played. Although it seems small, in my mind, it seems like the space that he played in was much, much bigger. But it must have been. You know how your mind makes some rooms bigger and some rooms. And right in that same room was where Alvin Barkley died. I remember he gave that wonderful speech in the Handmaiden in the Tents of the Lord, and we all cheered and we looked up, and he wasn't there. He was right there. He wasn't there when we looked back. Someone ran upstairs with a camera and on that track above and took a picture down over him, and they confiscated his camera immediately.
Oh, my God.
Oh. Another.
Now, were you a delegate at the mock convention?
I suppose I was there. I suppose I was.
Mm-hmm.
Another very memorable thing. This won't go in your book, but UC Björling came to the great Swedish tenor, one of the great, maybe the greatest since Caruso, came and sang in Roanoke. And I went with Whit Jack, a friend, and my parents, and to hear him sing. And I don't remember the taking music, but I remember that when I was a freshman, my father bought me a cheap record player and $25 worth of dollar classical records and said, it's a cheap experiment, maybe it'll take, and I fell in love with classical music and went to hear him, but I can't connect up with anything really in the school in classical music. But I remember in the freshman dormitory, there was a fair amount of interest, believe it or not, in classical music. Because this fellow Whit Jack and his roommate from New Orleans, they were next door. His roommate from New Orleans, who kept an MG behind the gym, of course it was illegal. He had his MG parked over there. He didn't stay. lots of the students left after a year or semester, you know.
Really?
Mm-hmm. You always, lots, I might be exaggerating, but the party scene was pretty compelling, and so a number of students didn't stay.
Was it for academic reasons?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One thing that I think is really interesting that I tell my students here, you know, class attendance is thin before and after vacations here, and perhaps at WNL now, but in those days, if you were absent from a class the day before or after a holiday, your relations with the university were severed, and it was very effective. Lots of friends went to the Bahamas for spring vacation, and I never went, but occasionally someone would just stay on and then reapply for admission. But people came back. So there was and of course the honor system was quite strict too.
Tell me about that.
Well, I was on the honor court, and I guess my last year. And if someone happened to be convicted, he was taken to a motel and not allowed even to go back to his room. His friends packed up for him, and he was out of town. So that was, at Davidson, you have a chance to come back, but at WNL, you simply transferred somewhere else. We have a very good honor system at Davidson, too, and I think that's very important.
Do you remember how you first learned about the honor system?
Well, we had an honor system at Episcopal High, too, that was also very effective. So it was just second nature that you simply did your work. And as a teacher, it certainly makes all the difference when you don't have to proctor a test. You simply leave the room and have take-home tests, take-home papers, things like that. I think that's very important. And that's one of the impressive things, I think, about the university. Let's see. President Gaines's marvelous Ciceronian orations stand out. I'm sure you've heard that before.
Oh, but do tell.
He gave those, again, in Doremus Gymnasium. That'll be nice because you know the gift of the Doremus family and the gymnasium. And so we've had, in that gym, we've had Louis Armstrong, Barclay's death, and President Gaines's orations. Wonderful words. You know, that's in this political year, you know, we've lost the sort of 19th century rhetoric, the biblical rhetoric. And when he spoke, it was authentic. It was the real thing. It was very stirring. You know, to the place of oratory and the body politic was impressed on me. Now, let's see now. One thing that I remember with pleasure was auditing courses. I tried to audit a lot of courses as well as take courses. For example, Harvey Wheeler's political science course. Ken Sadler was, I think, one of his students, and I would go with Ken and just listen to the, took a little pressure off. You didn't have to take the test, but you learned. I remember auditing the philosophy of religion, or did I take that? Oh, here's another. Dr. Pusey was, I thought, quite an inspiring man in his own understated, quiet way. When I first got to WNL, I was in upper-level French courses, and I can't remember I had to, but anyway, as a junior, I started German with Dr. Pusey. Actually, the first teacher was, it's a Spanish teacher's name, Barrett, is that right? He stood, I can't remember who stood in as a substitute. But in any case, I had Dr. Pusey for second year German. And this German has, that's meant a lot to me. I went to Salzburg for the summer, studied German, and worked on a German, and read German. And I think studying French and German helped prepare me for, you know, the academic life since I'd had Latin to high school. But let's see now.
You mentioned the women's colleges surrounding Washington. Was that an important part of your social life?
Oh yeah, it was wonderful. We had, you know, you'd have, if someone would be dating a fraternity brother, you had lots of friends in those women's colleges. You got, and it was a good atmosphere because you double dated, and I wasn't. And I think that the curfews and so on took a lot of pressure off. You know, you didn't have to stay up all night in some sort of endurance contest. And carloads would go, you know, to all those schools around there. And you have lots of blind dates, and you'd go down for the nice parties in the Hotel Roanoke and the big dances. And Randolph Macon, as you might know, has in its the lobby of the main building where you met your date a wonderful art collection. Now they have a separate building for their art collection. So it was civilizing for us. And the architecture of those schools, of course, the architecture of the front campus at W&L, but also the distinctive architecture of Sweetbriar, Randolph, Macon, Hollins, and Mary Baldwin. I thought that was all part of the genteel atmosphere that you don't realize is such a privilege until you leave it. Now, Davidson's a beautiful campus, but to be surrounded by beautiful buildings as well as the beautiful mountains is quite a privilege for young people, I think.
Did you go out into the countryside much?
Oh, yes, we went out lots into the countryside, up on the river, I guess, where near where your farm is.
Up to Goshen?
Up to Goshen. Mm-hmm. Groups of people would go up, and I don't remember any drownings while I was there. Unfortunately, there were a number of deaths in automobile wrecks and terrible. So that was the downside of, the dark side of getting in the car and going to visit women's schools and going to Goshen. So I had a good friend who was killed coming back from Goshen, Jacques Dubois from Mexico City. He was on the wrestling team. And there were a number of, Bill Lynn got killed. He's a friend from Lynchburg. I was a pallbearer in his funeral. At that time we had no understanding of the losses the parents of these young people felt. I remember Dean Gillum, I have to talk about Dean Gillum. He said that was the hardest, calling Jacques' father in Mexico City. It was the hardest telephone call he'd ever made. Went back to see Dean Gillam in his wonderful home, my mother and I did, before he died. And his brother, the Gillams were a Lynchburg family, my hometown, and I grew up next door to Dean Gillam's brother. And Tommy Gillam, also an SA, a couple of years younger, and I grew up together. He was Dean Gillam's. He lived in Charlottesville with his family. And Fontaine Gillam, his son, I've met at the W&L Davidson football game a couple of times down here, and we've had really wonderful chats. Do you know him?
Mm-hmm. I've met him.
Yeah. He lives in Spartanburg, I believe, Greenville. So Dean Gillam was a noble figure. He and his wife had been missionaries, teaching missionaries of a sort in, I believe, the Belgian Congo, and his wife's health had sent them back to the States. Is that right?
I didn't know that.
I believe so. And also, it was my understanding that he never took a drink, which was, he never said anything, but you know, there was a lot of drinking, and he was just sort of above. He was not, he was sort of an ideal, like Laban and those two men in particular. So self-control. I wouldn't want you to put that in there, that to give any indication that I think Flournoy was not a person to be respected, but you know, he did. Wouldn't put him in that category, but don't say anything about that, at least not from me, about his drinking. So, and of course, visiting in Dean and Mrs. Gillam's home was always very special. They had a Tudor home that you've perhaps been in. I don't know how many students saw the inside of that house, but it was quite a honor to be, you know, to pay a call on them.
Was there a lot of that kind of student socializing with the faculty or administration?
Not nearly as much as there used to be at Davidson. When I first came to Davidson, every Sunday night certain homes were open because Vespers was required.
Oh.
And so the students would come around and see us.
Oh.
We had nothing regular like that at W&L. Oh. It's not the same at Davidson anymore. But it was not, we were not as close, I think, as the students at Davidson used to be to the teachers.
Turn paper.
Okay.